I, Ketanji Brown Jackson,
do solemnly swear,
do solemnly swear,
that I will administer justice,
that I will administer justice,
without respect to persons,
without respect to persons,
and do equal right,
and do equal right,
to the poor and to the rich,
to the poor and to the rich,
and that I will faithfully and impartially.
Ketanji Brown Jackson, now officially Justice Jackson, taking her oath of office and formally joining the Supreme Court today, replacing Justice Stephen Breyer, who retired after nearly 30 years on the court. His last act was swearing in his successor. That moment wrapped up a monumental term that ended constitutional protections for abortion, expanded gun rights, and chipped away at the separation of church and state. Today, the court issued its last two rulings of the term. It limited the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to deal with climate change, and it sided with the Biden administration in its attempt to end President Trump's so-called Remain in Mexico immigration policy. The court also agreed to hear a case next fall from North Carolina that could change how federal elections are conducted. We're going to talk about all of this now with Press Play's Legal Eagle, the hardest working eagle around, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Hi.
Happy last day of the term. Hello.
Whew. Okay. Let us begin with the environmental case. So you have said that if it weren't for the Roe case, the Dobbs decision that ended Roe, this particular case would have been the biggest of the term. Why is that?
Well, because of how much is actually at stake. And so it might not sound as sexy, but what we're talking about here is the power of the federal government to issue rules and regulations. And specifically by federal government, we mean federal agencies. It's not just federal agencies like the EPA, it's federal agencies like the FDA. And that's actually where we can make a connection to the Dobbs decision. Obviously, the FDA and how readily abortion pills are allowed is going to be a big issue coming up. But to get back to the EPA case, what the court said here is, EPA, you went out of your lane when you tried to end or severely limit greenhouse gas emissions. You didn't have the statutory authority to do so. So on the one hand, you can say, well, it's just the court saying federal agencies don't act until Congress tells you to. But on the other hand, if we peel a layer back, it's a really big decision that doesn't just have huge environmental impact, but it's a really big decision about how specifically Congress needs to authorize federal agencies to act.
Okay, I want to get into that more in just a moment, but first, just tell us a little bit more about this particular case, the facts, and what the justices decided.
Absolutely. So this is actually a case that starts back in 1970 dealing with the Clean Air Act, which is a congressional statute. It's a fairly broad grant of authority to the EPA. And then we fast forward a number of decades to President Obama, who is saying to Congress, do something about greenhouse gas emission. You must do something. Congress, as is so often the case, and this is so often, you know, part three of our story, does nothing. And so President Obama then says, okay, I'm doing something by executive order instead. I'm ordering the EPA, this again, federal agency, to significantly pull back and to say that we need to really drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The rule never went into effect because it was challenged immediately. President Trump at the time then rolled it back. President Biden has said, well, I'm not going to do exactly that, but he basically does need some guidance about how much power the EPA has. And so that's the legal background of where the court gets to the place where they say, well, President Obama did not have the power. The EPA does not have the power to go this far. It was beyond what Congress authorized them to do.
Okay, so this is what Chief Justice John Roberts calls a major questions case. Where did that term come from? What does that mean?
So major questions, remarkably, is exactly what it sounds like. So often in the law, I say to my students, well, this isn't the way we use the term in common parlance. This is how we use the term in common parlance. It means that the EPA is making a decision that is not just a minor decision that says to power plants, here's what you can do on the plant itself. It's a major change. It's a major change to private companies. It's a major change to power plants to say, you need to significantly reduce your greenhouse gas emission. And it's a major change in the sense that it isn't necessarily written in the specific language of the statute that the EPA can do this. It's a big shift where what we're doing is we're looking at broad language in the congressional statute to say, we think that envisions this federal agency to be able to act. In this case, what the majority is saying here is actually when a federal agency, and I read this to be more than just the EPA, wants to make this kind of big seismic shift, they have to make sure they can do that based on a congressional statute.
Okay, we are going to get more into the nitty-gritties in this particular case in terms of how it affects climate and efforts to help mitigate the effects of climate change in the next segment. So let's move on to the other decision, this one concerning Biden's effort to end the Remain in Mexico policy. The Supreme Court says he can. What was the reasoning and what does it mean?
So this is a case that actually dealt with interpretation of federal immigration statutes. And there was a question about basically what is required when you don't have enough resources. Congress hasn't given the Department of Homeland Security enough resources to detain everybody who would be covered by a program where people are trying to cross the border by land and obtain asylum, for instance. And what the court found is that the President Biden has the power to end Remain in Mexico because we are not required to either say we have the resources to detain people or they must be sent back. That this isn't a must situation, it's a may situation. And so this was really all about a fight about what federal immigration law, which frankly, I've looked at all the statutes, they're a little bit conflicting, what exactly it means. The big decision here, I think, isn't that President Biden gets to end a policy by former President Trump. It's that any person in the Oval Office has the power to say that Remain in Mexico policy is not required under federal law.
All right. And we will look at the effects of that in the coming days to see what it actually means on the ground. And let's look ahead now to a case the court agreed to hear next term, which begins in October. This is a voting rights case out of North Carolina, and it could be very consequential. Tell us briefly about this one.
This is a huge case which looks like it's a voting rights gerrymandering case, but it's actually a much bigger and much more foundational question about what it means in the Constitution when it says that state legislatures determine the time, place, and manner of federal elections. We have always understood that legislature doesn't just mean members of the state assembly or the state senate, that it includes the lawmaking arms of the state. For instance, it includes the secretary of state. It includes state court judges. And so we have allowed state court judges to interpret and sometimes overturn election-related decisions that are made by state lawmakers. This particular question would say no. State lawmakers are the final word. Nobody can review their decisions when it comes to, nobody in the state can review their decisions when it comes to federal elections. That's a really huge deal, obviously huge implications for all sorts of voting laws, but it's particularly a big deal because just 3 years ago, I believe to the day, the Supreme Court said federal courts don't have any role in reviewing partisan gerrymandering, but don't worry, state courts do. This would mean really nobody does.
Ooh, all right. Well, we will definitely get your analysis when the time comes for arguments next fall. And hopefully we'll talk to you before then as well. But happy end of the court term. Jessica Levinson, take a break. You have earned it.
Thank you so much.
Jessica is a Loyola Law School professor, and she is our regular legal here on Press Play. Coming up, more on how the court's ruling limiting the power of the EPA will affect efforts to fight global warming next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's look more closely now at the Supreme Court's decision today against the Environmental Protection Agency. It limits the agency's ability to regulate carbon emissions from power plants, and it is a big obstacle now to President Biden's plans to drastically cut greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. Here to tell us more is Maxine Josselow. She covers climate change and writes the Climate 202 newsletter for The Washington Post. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so broadly, what does this mean for the president's plan? He really did want to curb the emissions at coal-fired power plants and the like. So what does this decision mean for that effort?
So you're right that President Biden has set out a goal, a very ambitious goal, to reduce emissions to net zero emissions from the nation's power sector by 2035 and to net zero emissions economy-wide by 2050. And this decision does not bode well for his ambitious climate agenda. It limits how far the EPA can go in making sweeping changes to the nation's power sector and requiring utility companies to transition away from coal, the dirtiest fossil fuel, and toward renewable energy without explicit approval from Congress.
Okay, so in the short term, what does that mean? Does it mean that coal-fired plants can keep on using coal and not transition to clean energy?
So in the short term, the EPA is still working to issue a final regulation governing the power sector and in particular greenhouse gas emissions, which contribute to climate change, that are emitted from coal and natural gas-fired power plants. So we'll have to wait to see what the EPA says in that final rule about what coal plants can and cannot do. I think lawyers at the EPA, as we speak, are very closely poring over this ruling and what it means for their authority. But the nation is already moving away from coal in large part because of market forces, kind of regardless of that regulation.
Well, how big a polluter are American power plants?
So the power sector is America's second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. That's according to EPA's own figures. Transportation, so cars, trucks, trains, planes, is actually the largest source at about 27%, followed by the power sector at about 25%. And when you talk about the power sector, power plants account for the majority of those emissions, particularly coal-fired power plants.
So some people poring over this decision today are saying it's not, you know, people who are on the environmental side are saying it's not the worst that they had feared, that this decision could have been a lot worse. What do you say about that?
I have heard the same thing from some of my sources, and so have some of my colleagues at The Washington Post who are also covering this decision. I think the worst case scenario that some environmental and climate activists feared was that the conservative majority on the Supreme Court was going to say that the EPA does not have the power at all to regulate greenhouse gases from power plants, from vehicles, from other industrial sources. And the majority did not say that. They did not in any way take away that authority. They just said that the agency cannot make sweeping changes by requiring specific coal plants, for example, to shift to cleaner energy. So it was less sweeping than some in the environmental community had had feared when they were thinking about, okay, what's the worst possible decision that I could imagine?
So basically, the justices were saying this has to be a case-by-case situation. They can't just take one case and then make us, elaborate from that, extrapolate and say, then the entire industry needs to follow this particular power plant's way of doing things as we order it.
Yeah. So if you don't mind, I'll get a little bit in the weeds with legal jargon just to explain a bit what the justices were saying in the majority opinion, which was written by Chief Justice Roberts. They invoked something called the major questions doctrine, which says that a federal agency like the EPA cannot interpret a law like the Clean Air Act in a really broad sweeping way unless Congress has clearly told them that they have permission to do that. And so here they found that the EPA did not get that explicit approval from Congress to make these sweeping changes to the nation's power sector, in particular to make sweeping changes to the entire sector rather than at individual plants, kind of like what you were saying.
What would this mean for regulating tailpipe emissions?
So this actually does not say anything about regulating greenhouse gases from vehicle tailpipes. The EPA last year finalized regulations limiting vehicle emissions and undoing President Trump's rollback of those regulations. And Republican attorneys general have also challenged those regulations, and that's pending in the DC Circuit Court of Appeals right now, and it has not made it up to the Supreme Court, although it certainly could.
Right. Another case that has made it to the Supreme Court, they will hear it next fall, is a challenge to the Clean Water Act. Can you tell us about that case?
Yes, that is another case that I am very closely tracking. And in that case, there's a challenge to the EPA's interpretation of what the Clean Water Act says should be the proper definition of waters of the United States. And the plaintiffs in that case argue that the EPA has been using a much too broad definition that really encroaches on property owners when they're trying to build something on their property and they need to apply for a permit because EPA deems that there's a wetland on their property when, in fact, the plaintiffs argue this is not a wetland and that is just adding unnecessary red tape. So the oral arguments in that case are scheduled for the Supreme Court's fall term, which begins in October.
And what is the concern there that if they rule in favor of the plaintiffs, that this could endanger a lot of federally protected waterways?
Yes, that is the concern. And there are different estimates out there from different experts analyzing the data as to what percentage of federal waterways would lose federal protections if the court were to adopt a much narrower interpretation of what constitutes waters of the United States. But I've seen estimates out there that as much as 90% of waterways could lose those protections.
Wow. So earlier you said that industry is moving away from carbon-based emissions for power. So could there be a market solution to the curtailing of the EPA's authority to regulate clean air?
Yeah, so I think regardless of what happens with the EPA's regulations, market forces are pushing the country in the direction of cleaner and cleaner energy. And the coal sector is on the decline, no matter what EPA decides to do with its final regulation for that sector. It's having trouble competing economically with natural gas and renewable energy, the cost of which have both fallen, while the price of natural gas has gone up a little bit amid the war in Ukraine. In general, coal has been struggling to compete economically with those other power sources, and we've seen the retirement of a lot of coal plants across the country in recent years.
Maxine Gelsolo covers climate change at The Washington Post. Maxine, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, we will have your weekend movie reviews, including a drama starring Ralph Fiennes and Jessica Chastain as a wealthy couple in Morocco.
The movie is clearly very angry at colonialism. It is clearly very angry at white people infecting a place like Morocco.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. Time to talk about new movies. William Bibbiani is here. He is film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Welcome back.
Hello. Good to be here.
Great to have you. And Christy Lemire writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. Welcome to you, Christy.
Hello, hello.
First up, Minions, The Rise of Gru. This is the fifth installment in the Despicable Me franchise, starring Steve Carell, Michelle Yeoh, and Taraji P. Henson.
Oh, my minions will save me.
You like picking on little guys, huh? I am a master of kung fu.
Teach a new kung fu for smoochy smoochy.
I will teach you.
All right, Christy, what is the plot here?
There are always more minions. They just keep multiplying. So this is a Gru origin story, right? Prior to this, we had a whole Minions movie where we learned about the origin of the minions and how they always flock to whatever supervillain it is that they can do their bidding for. This is how they help Gru become Gru. It is 12-year-old Gru, still voiced by Steve Carell, but he sounds like a tween version of Gru. And it's how he tries to get in with them, but then there's some mishap involving this MacGuffin-y green medallion thing that has all kinds of power, and like it gets lost and the minions have to help retrieve it. And it is just, it's nonsense. It's just noise and it's just an assault. It is just overwhelming, and it is basically just the minions being insane. And it fundamentally misses what is interesting about any of these movies in the first place. Like, nobody cares about Gru. Gru is not interesting. The minions are cute and they are fun. And when it's about them doing silly stuff, that is fun. But even an entire hour and a half long movie of that is too much. And 12-year-old Gru is no more interesting than adult Gru. I watched this with Nick, my 12-year-old son, and he was totally bored. I think this is really, really for just very little kids only.
Okay, Bibbs?
I'm not sure little kids are going to like it that much either. Listen, this is hardly like the most painful thing I've ever sat through, but it is one of the most perfunctory. Like, Michelle Yeoh's entire character lifts out of the movie completely. Every time she's on screen, I love Michelle Yeoh. I'm glad she got a paycheck, but she's there to pad the film. There's only about maybe 30 minutes of actual plot in this thing, which would be fine maybe if some of the comedy set pieces were really funny and it was just an excuse to get to them. I don't think it's not so much that we don't care about Gru. It's that the reason why we cared about Gru in the original Despicable Me is because he changed away from this. He was a bad guy who realized that he had a heart and was a good guy. And this is a movie about him wanting to be a bad guy, but then the movie can't even commit to that because he's still got to really love the minions. And anytime he steals something, he's only got to steal it from bad people. Like, he doesn't steal from a bank. He steals from the bank of evil. Like, they really are absolutely terrified of their own concept. And they're running from it as much as they possibly can, because Gru cannot actually be evil, no matter how much he claims it. So the whole movie feels really false and disingenuous. And yeah, it does not really work at all.
Okay. Minions, The Rise of Gru, in wide release tomorrow. Up next, The Forgiven. This is a noir based on a 2012 novel by Lawrence Osborne. It's about a privileged couple who are headed to a party in the Moroccan desert when something terrible happens. It stars Jessica Chastain and Ralph Fiennes.
You got into a car with a drunk, which makes you an accessory.
I feel like I've been an accessory for a long time now.
Now listen, are you going to mope all weekend, or are you going to enjoy yourself?
I suppose I could make the effort.
Zitmas Nacht will die.
He wants you to return with them to bury the boy. It is customary in these parts.
All right, Bibbs, what's going on here?
Okay, so this is the latest film from John Michael McDonough, who had previously directed some really great morality tales in The Guard and Calvary. And here, Ralph Fiennes and Jessica Chastain, they're in Morocco. They're going to a fancy party for really rich white people. And along the way, he gets drunk. They're driving in the middle of the night, and they run over a local boy. The boy dies. And so what happens is Ralph Fiennes goes off with the family to bury the dead and give his respects, even though he is outwardly exceptionally racist. And Jessica Chastain, who has been trapped in a loveless marriage with this guy for 12 years, is stuck at the party. And so the movie then bifurcates and becomes half about Ralph Fiennes sort of coming to terms with his racism, his colonialism, and maybe growing a bit as a person. And Jessica Chastain enjoying the hedonistic lifestyle and maybe coming into her own as a person. And it's weird how treacly that kind of sounds when you say it, because the movie is incredibly depressed. And the movie is clearly very angry at colonialism. It is clearly very angry at white people infecting a place like Morocco. And just using it as a tourist trap. But I think it overplays our sympathy with these two protagonists who, you know, they have lessons to learn and such, but I don't care about them.
Christy, Great Gatsby in the desert or not?
It's funny you mentioned that, because in my review for RogerEbert.com, I sort of paraphrased that, the whole like, these are careless people, you know, Tom and Daisy. Yeah. I borrowed from that, because they are all awful. I don't think this is a film noir. I don't think it's a morality tale. I think it's a satire of white privilege. And they are traipsing across the desert, and they don't really view the locals as human beings who might have traditions or customs or lives of their own. They're just sort of there to be servants, and they're there to be in the way. And so when this teenager's death happens, when Ralph Fiennes' character causes this teenager's death, it's initially just an inconvenience. It's just like a detour when they should be partying all weekend long. And the dialogue is so blunt that it's being used as a cudgel, as if these people's actions alone weren't sufficient to indicate to us how awful everybody is. I thought that Ismail Kanitor as the teenage boy's father was particularly good, because at first he's got this kind of quiet, stoic, simmering rage, and it almost feels like a stereotypical kind of like martyrish portrayal, but then he's allowed to show so much more. So there are pieces here that work. It's well made, but ultimately I think it's sort of a big shrug.
All right, The Forgiven is in limited release beginning tomorrow. Up next, we have Mr. Malcolm's List. This is, I guess, sort of Bridgerton / Jane Austen-esque. Here's a clip.
My dearest Selina, will you come visit me in London? I promise you will be well entertained.
There is a gentleman, Mr. Malcolm.
He humiliated me.
No. I then found out he had a list.
You have a list of qualifications for a bride.
I would love for Mr. Malcolm to receive the comeuppance he deserves.
Plus, it could be rather fun.
Christy, is it rather fun?
Oh, it's totally Bridgerton. It's not even kind of, sort of. It absolutely is. And I mean, starting with the fact that you have a narrator talking about how it's the new season and who is the most eligible bachelor. But it is a comedy and it is a romance. And it's about how people are manipulating each other as the season goes along. The very eligible and handsome Mr. Malcolm, played by Sope Jirisu, he's single. He is the catch of the season, but he notoriously has this list of requirements for whoever is going to be his betrothed. And when he humiliates Zawi Ashton's character, she becomes the laughingstock because they have a bad date at the opera. She enlists her childhood friend from girls' school, played by Frida Pinto, to come to London from the country to do the season and trick him with her own list and get revenge. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't you know, they actually fall for each other. And so it's just sort of a comedy of, you know, deception and misunderstanding, and it's a good light escape. And just Frida Pinto is just a stunningly gorgeous creature at all times. And so I enjoyed it.
Bibbs, did you?
I did, very, very much so. It is very formulaic, but there are certain kinds of movies that we go to see a formula. Nobody goes to a rom-com wanting everyone to end up murdered at the end. Like, we want to see something reassuring. And so this story about a really, relationship that starts with deception, but wouldn't you know it, they get closer together. Will the lie be revealed? Yes. Yes, it will. This is a very charming romantic comedy. It doesn't have the rapier wit of some of the better, you know, Jane Austen adaptations, and it doesn't have a hell of a lot to say about anything. It's not, also like Jane Austen, it's not a social commentary in any meaningful sort of way. It's just the patina of a period piece draped over a 1990s romantic comedy. But it is a lovely one of those, and I had a really good time. I think other people will too.
All right, Mr. Malcolm's List in limited release beginning tomorrow. Finally, a documentary called Accepted about a group of students attending a rural Louisiana college prep school that advertised getting its graduates into Ivy League schools, except it was later revealed there was some fraud and abuse going on there.
I have practically a whole new family.
We work our asses off. It's like boot camp.
Oh, we're not raising sheep here. We're raising the wolves. I am somebody.
A lot of people had an image of the school being perfect. And it wasn't perfect.
All right, Bibbs, we can find out what happened at that school by Googling and reading the New York Times expose. But tell us about this documentary. Does it do a good job telling the story?
It does an exceptional job telling the story. This is the story of T.M. Landry Prep School in Louisiana. And it is a very small school that boasted, and I don't know if the number is still accurate, but a 100% college acceptance rate for its students, and a shocking number got into Ivy League schools. And the first chunk of this documentary is all about selling T.M. Landry the way T.M. Landry sells it, as this almost utopian ideal of the perfect school where everyone feels like they found their community, they feel like they found the right teacher, they're learning above what people would consider to be their grade level, they are being given all the tools they need to succeed in a system which is built against them. And then we get to see all those videos that went viral. And then we get to find out that all of that attention brought some really troubling things to light, some of which involved transcripts that may or may not have been fraudulent, and test scores that might not actually have accurately reflected what the kids actually know about the subjects. This is a very well-crafted documentary that gives you, yeah, you could get the story on the Wikipedia page, but I think you're going to feel the story and understand more about it.
Christy, did you love it too?
I did. This movie is a roller coaster. And what happens over the course of making this film is so fascinating, because the director, Dan Chen, set out to make one kind of movie and was following along with Mike Landry and with all these kids because, yeah, these videos were thrilling. These viral videos of kids getting into Harvard and Georgetown and everyone exploding with rapturous joy around them. And so he went in at first to make a movie about that. And then this New York Times investigation came out. And so he had to pivot midway through and follow through with this story from a different angle. And then how he adapted when the access started getting cut off, when Mike Landry wasn't quite so boisterous on camera, wasn't quite so prepared, when he got more paranoid and didn't even want to talk to him, but this guy still had a movie to make. And so he shows it from all angles, from how the kids reacted, from how the parents reacted. And so they felt kind of deceived. And the loss of identity is quite heartbreaking, because as Bibbs pointed out, they all felt like, here's who I am. Here is my home. Here is my family. And to have that shattered is troubling to them. And there are some cult-like elements to it that we begin to see, that these kids begin to recognize, in terms of being ostracized once they leave. It's a really good story, and it's the flip side of the coin from the Operation Varsity Blues scandal. You know, everyone's trying to game the system. Everyone's trying to get in. But no matter how hard these kids work, the rich white kids who buy their way into USC are always going to prevail. And so the goal at the heart of it is the same: providing a future for these kids, your own kids, you know, no matter what background they come from. And the fact that both of these schemes determine that the ends justify the means is kind of fascinating.
All right, that sounds really great. Accepted in limited release and on demand beginning tomorrow. And that is it for our film review segment. It was a good one. Christy Lemire writes for RogerEbert.com and co-hosts the podcast Breakfast All Day. William Bibbiani is film critic for The Wrap and co-host of the critically acclaimed network. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Jenny Slate and Dean Fleischer Camp are here to talk about their movie, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's been just over a decade since a little seashell with a googly eye, pink sneakers, and an adorable voice captured the internet's heart.
My name is Marcel, and I'm partially a shell, as you can see on my body, but I also have shoes and a face, so I know how it looks in here, but it's not always so messy, but I didn't know that you were going to have a camera, and I wish that you had said that you were going to be here today, because I didn't clean up.
Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, the 3-minute homemade video first posted on YouTube, now has, well, more than 32 million views. There were 2 follow-ups, books, and now a full-length movie where Marcel is on the hunt to find his family.
Sometimes I find my mind wandering, thinking, what would my family think? Do you think they could be out there?
Marcello, let's forget about being afraid. Just take the adventure.
That's Isabella Rossellini there as the voice of the grandma. Joining me now is the talent that created Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, Jenny Slate, the writer and voice of Marcel, Dean Fleischer Camp, also writer, creator of Marcel, and he's also in the movie. He plays himself. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you for having us.
Great to have you both. Okay, so take us back to 2010 at the birth of Marcel. Dean, you came up with this idea of the shell, the talking shell?
Really, it was a joint effort, but it began with Jenny doing the voice. I don't know if you want to tell sort of the origin point of that, Jenny.
Yeah, sure. Dean and I were at a wedding and we were sharing a hotel room with a few other friends in an attempt to save money. I just started feeling really, really squished and small and maybe a little bit irritated at the mess. And I started, my reaction was to start talking in this little voice. And it, I think we liked how it sounded when it said things. I think we just liked its timbre. And so Dean asked me if he could interview me in that voice because he had a video to make for a friend's live comedy show and he hadn't made it yet and the clock was ticking. And so he asked, could I interview you? And maybe, you know, that voice will kind of say something and I'll like animate something or make something to go with it. Yeah. And so that's how it started.
We had kind of written a couple of like those, the sort of classic Marcel one-liners. But then what gave it kind of more depth was the sort of more improv-y like question and answer session that we did where Jenny was just kind of improvising, you know, like very quickly because I had procrastinated doing this assignment to the last minute, ran out to the craft stores and like, put, you know, cobbled together this little character and then animated it and edited it and screened it for an audience all within like 48 hours.
Oh, wow.
But it was, yeah, you know, people at this sort of art comedy variety show really responded to it. And someone in the audience who was sort of a friend asked if I could put it online. Remember, this is 2010, so it's not like everything, like YouTube wasn't so ubiquitous and it wasn't completely common to put every scrap of creativity online. This woman asked me if I could put it on the internet because she wanted to share it with her grandmother who had recently like broken her hip. And so I did, and that was the only reason that I put it online.
Oh, wow. But it must have taken a long time because it's stop motion, right? To animate?
You know, if you're abusing caffeine pills and staying up all night working, it's amazing what you can get done.
Okay, so you put it online just for the sick grandma or the grandma who broke her hip. And then how does it get bigger than just a few people seeing it.
Yeah, how does it get bigger, Dean? How does that like, I know, I remember Dean showing it to me and being like, look, like, you know, 400 people saw it and me just being confused. Like, how are they finding it and how?
I think that back then there was a truly like democratic process for YouTube videos going viral, and it didn't happen that commonly. You know, there's one or two places to find videos, and you literally was people like just totally grassroots, like, hey, you know, Meemaw, come look at this video that made me laugh. I think it's gonna make you laugh. And it got spread that way. I do know that one of the first people with any sort of like platform was
VideoGum, right?
Yeah, was our friend Gabe Delahaye, who ran this website called VideoGum.
Yeah, I guess we have to thank Gabe Delahaye for a lot, really. We should send some flowers over there. Sure. We'll talk about it after this.
It's funny because I thought for a long time that Marcel the Shell was a girl. I just realized that Marcel's not a girl. So, Jenny, how do you envision Marcel and who he is when you embody him?
You know, Marcel is really willing to show himself, but he doesn't really perform an identity. He just shows what's there. And when I'm performing him, I kind of follow that rule. I like playing Marcel because he is a different thing. He's really capable, but he is someone who, you know, whose situation is defined by his own grief.
And he's grieving the loss of his family because the people who lived in this house, they took all his other shelf family away, or one of them did when they broke up. And then, Dean, this is where you come in, because then the house is an Airbnb and you're renting it, right? Because you and Jenny have broken up in real life, right?
Well, not me and Jenny that have broken up, but it is, I am playing a version.
It's just interesting, the crossovers, because you're playing yourself.
I think that I wanted to make a film that was very personal, and so did Jenny, and we felt good about folding those parts of ourselves into it, because part of what made this character special to begin with is how much kind of there's like a porous membrane with our real relationship, and it felt holistic with the character we'd created and the way that we made the shorts. It is a movie that looks and feels like a documentary and is ostensibly a documentary, but it's not a documentary. I'm playing, you know, a version of myself, and that version of myself doesn't perfectly align with like everything in my real life. Jenny and I created Marcel at a time when we both felt a little bit voiceless and a little bit unseen. That sort of struggle about being heard and seen, and am I small or do I deserve more, is baked into his DNA because of where we were.
And do you think that that is why he's resonated so much with people, that he does embody that idea of being small and wanting to be seen?
Yeah, for sure. I think we all know the feeling of kind of being like making do in a world that wasn't built for us from childhood. Like, Marcel doesn't see the impossibility when obstacles get thrown his way, even though he's, you know, living this outsized world and the obstacles are huge. He doesn't take them personally. He doesn't begrudge them. And he just overcomes them.
I love this. You take him out to see LA. and then you take him up to, I don't know, like up a mountain or somewhere. I don't know. And he's looking at the valley, I guess.
Yeah.
And he's so underwhelmed. Even though he's never seen the real world before, right?
Yeah.
He's also let down by the largeness of the outside. Like, what I'm glad is that we don't show him, like, feeling a fool, basically, like, thinking, like, oh, man, I thought I could do this thing that I want to do, like, go out there and find my family, and now I realize, like, I really didn't get it. I really didn't get how big it is. I just think that it's nice to see someone going through experiences that definitely are experiences of like being let down and being alone and not understanding what's going on, really. And also seeing things for like seeing new things. And that what takes up most of the space is just like the individual, not like the loudness of the thing he's experiencing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I can remember when we were writing that part of the movie, because when, you know, he's seeing the world for the first time, the audience's expectation is, okay, well, he's either going to find his family, unlikely, or he's going to not find his family, likely. How do you make that a surprise? And I think the way that we figured out how to turn that scene and create a revelation that wasn't expected is by him actually not just not getting what he wanted, but actually being completely confronted with the real size of the ambition of what he was planning. And Marcel is a corollary for experiences we've all had. We've all felt confident in something and then realized that actually we were like way out of our depth and we didn't understand the complexity or what we were asking.
Yeah, all of us feel that way all the time. Why does he like 60 Minutes so much?
I mean, I remember watching 60 Minutes as a little girl and like being so like fascinated by why they didn't even have a theme song, like that it's just a clock with the hands, you know, like that's so bold. You're not even trying to make it exciting. Like what's inside must be good enough, you know, like must be thrilling enough that it's like a book with a blank cover almost. It's just like a, believe me, you know, you don't need to know, just get in here and you'll see it.
What you just said, Jenny, I think it's how we feel about Marcel a lot of the time, about it not needing like a flashy cover, like just get in here. That's why we've taken a long time and really taken our time with expanding Marcel into a larger world, is that that's how we feel about him. But film and entertainment exists in a marketplace where, you know, you have to do some degree of having a really flashy book cover. Both of us always just feel like, nah, come on, just get in here. Like, this doesn't have to look like something else. It doesn't have to appeal in the way that a bigger Disney movie might. Come on, get in here.
So you guys broke up before you made this movie. And how did you get back together to make it? Was that difficult?
Dean was saying earlier today, and I, like, this is the right way to put it, I think, at least, you know, from what I experienced, is that like we met working together. We've, you know, always been really drawn to the way each other does their creative thing. I've never met anyone who thinks like Dean, who creates the beautiful things that he creates, the visuals, and has also such a strong comedy sense. I 100% trust him. So it's just a long-standing relationship. That's the thing that I think we do the best. And I feel really fortunate that I got to continue on in that connection, because the work that I'm able to make in partnership with Dean, I'm so proud of it. Yeah, I don't know how to say it. Like, there's no big deal about it.
Is it the same for you, Dean?
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. I mean, Jenny and I met working together. I'm such a huge fan of hers as a performer and as an artist. And you sort of, especially when you're younger, when you meet someone who sort of you click with creatively, it's so invaluable. You sort of shape one another's aesthetic and view of the world. And so we continue to share that. And I think it makes me super happy to get to do it. And I hope that Jenny is as like wowed by my creative talents as I regularly am of hers.
I definitely am.
Aw. So, and then they don't live together. Are they?
Who's that?
Circumstances tear them apart.
Me and Jenny?
Dean and Marcel. I don't care about you guys. I want to know about Dean and Marcel.
No, it's nice that they don't live together, because then they have to figure out how to continue their relationship when they're not stuck together, because it's a disaster. That's really wonderful. You know, Marcel at the end, he goes over to visit, and I love that part. I generally also like it when you think a movie is over and then there's fun little scenes over the credits. I like love that trick. I also love a blooper, but we didn't have any. Marcel never does anything wrong. So, you know, but there is that moment at the end where Marcel says, you know, you're welcome back anytime you want. It's an acknowledgement. And there are a couple times throughout the movie where, you know, there's one time where Marcel thinks that Dean is leaving, and, you know, because he sees the suitcase, and Dean says, like, where am I going to go? In a way, you're like glad that he didn't go right then, because it's such a hard time for Marcel. But you're also aware, like, but, you know, it's not going to be the best for them if they stay here like this forever. Like, they're not like old widowers, you know, like they have their whole lives ahead of themselves.
Yeah.
Like, even though we don't know
Felix
how old
and Oscar,
Marcel is.
Right.
Yeah.
Felix right. And Oscar, right. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like to our point about this having sort of like a connection to our real relationship, the measure of a relationship is not like that it goes on forever until one of you buries the other one. It's that it should be that you love each other enough to see one another through to your next stage or your next, you know, path, and to not sort of unnecessarily linger on that old fashioned thing. And, you know, the movie's all about how you can't have growth without death. And that applies to everything.
Dean, that's such a beautiful thing to say, and I don't think I could have said it better.
Oh, it was great talking to you again, and thanks for coming on. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Actress and writer Jenny Slate, writer-director Dean Fleischer Kemp. They are the creators of Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, which is currently playing in select theaters in Los Angeles and New York. And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Brian Hartzinski, Angie Perrin, Bennett Purser, Marcel Hutchins, and Nihar Patel. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney is our managing producer. And our technical director is Mario Saavedra. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you next week.